searches to explore the vast, uncharted depths of the oceans.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, verses number 29 and 30, recited by Saeed Maliki.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Qul in تخفوا ما في صدوركم أو تبدوه يعلمه الله ويعلم ما في السماوات وما في الأرض والله على كل شيء قدير يوم تجد كل نفس ما عملت من خير محضرا وما عملت من سوء تود لو أن بينها وبينه أمدا بعيدا ويحذركم الله نفسه
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, whether you hide what is in your heart or manifest it, Allah knows it, and He knows whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth, and Allah has power over all things. On the day that every soul shall find present what it has done of good and what it has done of evil, it shall wish that between it and that evil there were a long duration of time. And Allah makes you to be cautious of retribution from Himself, and Allah is compassionate to the servants.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Police in Britain and Germany did arrest dozens of people during protests against coronavirus lockdown. Thousands of French people hold a rally in Paris to protest against racism and police violence. Saudi Arabia conducts fresh airstrikes on Yemen, targeting the international airport in the capital, Sana'a. Welcome to the program. Police have arrested 36 people during anti-lockdown protests in the British capital, London, as thousands rallied to demand an end to coronavirus restrictions. The arrests were made as protesters scuffled with officers in Hyde Park in central London. Police say several officers were also injured after demonstrators threw projectiles. Coronavirus restrictions imposed in January banned Londoners from leaving their homes except for a limited number of reasons. Anger is also boiling in the city over police violence during a recent vigil held for a woman kidnapped and murdered by an officer. Police violence led to calls, including by the Liberal Democrat leader in Parliament, for the London police chief to resign. Arrests are made in Germany as some 20,000 people from across the country, gather in the city of Kassel to protest coronavirus restrictions. Police deployed water cannons and used pepper spray to disperse the protesters, who fought back, hitting officers with projectiles. The protest came amid anger over the government's lack of a clear policy to end the coronavirus lockdowns, with vaccination lagging behind countries like the US and the UK. And meanwhile, similar protests were held in the northern Swiss town of Liestal. There, some 5,000 people rallied to demand an end to anti-COVID measures, the protesters held placards reading "Enough," denouncing what they called the government's use of dictatorial powers to impose COVID restrictions. Thousands of French people have marched in Paris to protest against racism and police violence. The protest was held amid heavy police presence in the capital. They voiced opposition to a proposed security law known as the Global Security Bill and slammed it as a violation of their rights. The bill includes an article that would criminalize the publication of images of on-duty police officers. It would also extend police surveillance powers through the use of CCTV and drones. Critics say the move would restrict filming of police and posting of images to social media, notably to document cases of police brutality. Now, Chile registers over 7,000 new COVID-19 cases, breaking its single-day record for infections of the coronavirus. A fast-rising caseload has filled critical care wards, leaving Chile with only 200 beds available for new patients. Following the surge in cases, all of the capital, Santiago, is in strict lockdown this weekend. So far, the virus has claimed more than 22,000 lives out of over 925,000 cases in Chile. Meanwhile, Brazil reported some 2,400 new COVID-19 deaths, raising the total to nearly 293,000. The Brazilian Health Ministry also registered over 79,000 additional confirmed cases of the virus, bringing the overall tally to nearly 12 million. Saudi Arabia has carried out fresh airstrikes on Yemen, targeting Sana'a's international airport. Yemeni media said the airport was hit twice, but there were no immediate reports on possible danger, or I should say damage or casualties. In fact, the Saudi-led coalition's warplanes also conducted airstrikes against targets at a port in the western province of Hodeidah. Riyadh and its Arab allies launched a deadly war and blockade on Yemen in 2015. The conflict has killed tens of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians, and resulted in what the UN calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The Yemeni army has in recent weeks ramped up its retaliatory attacks on Saudi Arabia. Now, over 500 international organizations urged the UN Human Rights Council to denounce Israel's war crimes against Palestinian people. The organizations called on the world body to establish an independent fact-finding mission into Israel's apartheid regime. They called for an investigation of the crimes the regime has committed against Palestinians, including home demolitions and illegal settlement construction in the occupied West Bank. The organizations urged the international community to use all available mechanisms to achieve international justice and accountability. They called for immediate action against Israel to hold accountable individuals who may have committed war crimes against Palestinians. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been facing months of protests over his corruption charges and handling of the coronavirus crisis. During our news review program, we discussed that issue with our guests.
Thousands of Israelis have held a fresh demonstration against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Jerusalem Al-Quds. Protesters gathered outside Netanyahu's residence to condemn his policies and call for his resignation. The rally was held just days before a general election, which could see him removed from office. Netanyahu has been in power for a record 12 consecutive years. He's hoping to remain in office following Israel's fourth election in less than 2 years, this March 23rd. Netanyahu is facing corruption charges. He went on trial in May for bribery, fraud, and breach of trust, but denies any wrongdoing. Israelis have been staging street rallies against him over the past 38 weeks. And now joining us for this news review is Yves Angler, author and commentator from Montreal, and Firas Al-Maji, manager at Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, joining us out of Ottawa. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. Firas, I guess we'll start with you. Your thoughts on, I mean, there was a time that Benjamin Netanyahu was very popular with his own people. What's happened to him?
Well, I guess first I want to congratulate everybody for Nowruz that's celebrating. Netanyahu is a big war criminal. The man has committed many war crimes himself. Before he was elected as a prime minister, you know, he's been an IDF soldier and he's been up in the ranks. This person is, he has no respect for any international laws. Obviously, that means he doesn't have any respect for any laws inside of his country. A person that doesn't care about any laws, you know, and dealings with the whole world. And he called the ICC, the International Criminal Court, a kangaroo court. He has no respect for any courts, any court systems, any governments. He sent out his Mossad to assassinate people in different places in the world. I mean, like we said, like this, it's nice to see that there's actually a movement from inside that is against him. But we don't know what the results are going to be. Like, is he going to be ousted? Is he not going to regain power?
Okay, thank you. And Yves Angler, I'd like to welcome you to the program. Now, 38 weeks, that's almost a year of protesting outside his residence there. And for the majority of it, for practically all of it, it's been throughout this pandemic. So people have been, you know, braving, risking their health to get their point across to their so-called prime minister. Your thoughts on what's irked the Palestinians, the Israelis, to this point where they turned against this man?
Well, my understanding is that it's about his corruption. It's about his handling of the pandemic. It's not much about his ongoing dispossession of Palestinians, the continued occupation, Israeli bombing in Syria, Israel's assassinations in Iran, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that it is, you know, it's better that there are Israelis protesting Netanyahu than not. I think that for most of the world, for most people who, care about the long oppressed Palestinians, whether it's Netanyahu or Naftali Bennett that wins the upcoming election, it's not going to change things a whole lot, unfortunately. In fact, this might be the first time that a non-Likud right-wing president wins, or prime minister, sorry, takes over in Israel, because it's the whole spectrum in Israel has gone so far to the anti-Palestinian racist kind of direction. But yeah, it's a good thing they're protesting, and I think there's some element of sympathy for Palestinians among the protesters. But unfortunately, that's not the driving force.
And Yves, do you think it's just a denunciation of Netanyahu himself by these protesters, or the greater Likud party?
Yeah, I think it's a heavily personalized element, which is understandable. I mean, he's been there for way too long. He is corrupt. He's a bad guy. But I think that unfortunately for those looking from outside, the getting rid of Netanyahu won't change things as much as need to be changed.
And do you agree with that, Firas, that Netanyahu is just, one part of the one piece of this this puzzle, that, whether it's him or Gantz or any other guy, basically, Palestinians are going to suffer apartheid and marginalized living standards?
Yes, this is systematic. They have this embedded in their system that the Palestinians have no rights. The Palestinians should be, driven out of the country. I mean, like we've seen with the deal of century, what they crafted there was a joke, It's a joke of the century. I mean, they want to leave them like leftovers on the side and put them in pretty much like kind of concentration camps and have no military and no strength at all. And it's exactly like how Trump is and Biden. I mean, they're both, involved in all the war crimes and exploiting and plundering resources, dividing the region, and so on. And that's the agenda of the Israelis. At the end of the day, it's the Zionists, they're going to continue to do it. They just have different faces. I guess the people are just sick of this face. They want a new face, just like how people were sick of Trump. I mean, even though Trump didn't stay for 12 years, but because of the things that he did, he worked very arrogantly, very unprofessional, so that's why they got rid of him. This guy was able to stay longer inside power because he's better at deceiving and manipulating and acting. He's a good actor, I guess. And he doesn't, you know, he doesn't just show exactly his arrogance as much as, for instance, Trump is. So, yeah, it's going to continue the same kind of war crimes, same kind of violations, you know, I guess there is some resistance in the region that will you know how to deal with the situation, hopefully.
All right, gentlemen, thank you both for joining us. And Yves Engler, author and commentator, joining us out of Montreal, and Firas Al-Najim, manager at Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, joining us out of Ottawa.
Turkey has reportedly carried out its first airstrikes in 17 months against an area in Syria held by Kurdish forces. A UK-based monitoring group says Turkish fighter jets pounded the positions of Syrian Democratic Forces near the northern town of Ain Issa. There have been no reports on possible casualties. Turkey launched a military campaign against Kurdish forces in northern Syria in October of 2019. It stopped the operation 2 months later after seizing control of a safe zone deep inside Syria. However, Ain Issa remained in the hands of U.S.-backed Kurdish forces. The air raids came days after violent clashes between Kurds and Turkish-backed militants in Ain Issa. Hundreds of people have gathered outside the Georgia state capital in Atlanta in support of the Asian American community. The protest comes amid mounting violence against the Asian community or being blamed for the coronavirus crisis. The demonstrators carried posters that is bearing slogans denouncing discrimination against Asians. Two Georgia senators also took part in the rally. Earlier, U.S. President Joe Biden denounced the rise of hate crimes and violence against Asian Americans in his country. This comes after eight people, mostly Asian women, were killed in a series of attacks in Atlanta.
The United States has witnessed yet another hate crime against minority groups that sparked a nationwide debate over the threats these people are facing in the country. On Wednesday, a white man gunned down eight people, including six Asian women at spas around Atlanta. The incident raised fears that it might be a new wave of attacks on Asian Americans. A report released by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence said racially motivated extremists pose the most lethal domestic terrorism threats to the U.S. It also warned that threats from domestic violent extremism are metastasizing across the country and could grow in 2021. Hate crimes against minorities in the U.S. have significantly increased over the past years, as former President Donald Trump explicitly favored white people over people of color. Many African Americans and Hispanics have been attacked or killed by white police officers or extremist groups. Asian Americans are in no better condition. They have been grappling with a rise in hate crimes since the coronavirus outbreak, as Trump directly blamed China for the pandemic. Now the question is, how would a country whose foundation has been built on killing the minorities manage to get rid of racism, which has been entrenched in its culture for centuries?
And now, people in Iran and several other countries are celebrating the ancient festival of Nowruz, which marks the beginning of the Persian calendar year. People usually become shopping frenzy to prepare themselves for the arrival of spring. In Iran, Nowruz falls on March the 21st of every year. That should be one of the traditions of Nowruz is to set a table called haftsin, which contains seven items beginning with the Persian S sound. Iranians both inside the country and abroad are in a festive mood as the day starts with a week-long holiday. Folks also make New Year resolutions, hoping to have a better year ahead. Another Nowruz tradition is to call on relatives and have good get-togethers with family and friends. However, people this year have been advised to stay home and avoid travels and gatherings due to the coronavirus outbreak. Mohsen Fatemi, a professor at Ferdowsi University in Mashhad, says Nowruz is about both internal development and external rejuvenation.
Nowruz comes with the concept of consummation, well-being, and wellness in terms of preparation and flexibility towards revitalizing yourself, not only in the external world, as you see people are going to, you know, change their decoration, they're going to redo everything in their houses, in their homes and everything, and paraphernalias are somehow going to be changed. But along with this change, which would be the manifestation of the external world, they would prepare themselves for a change from deep down the realm of the intrapersonal level. And that's the great things about Nowruz, that Nowruz is not only calling for liveliness and wellness and health and well-being and a sort of journey towards consummation, but also it asks people to acknowledge the possibility of renewing themselves, to be prepared for an exhilarating sort of cynosure for possibility of understanding everything, including themselves, in a new world with possibility of growth and development.
That's your world news for now. Stay tuned.
With the spring, the season of renewal and freshness, and the greening of nature, we here at IRIB English Radio wish you happiness, prosperity, and good health.
On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah,
I am quit before thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to thee, addressing myself to thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to you for the hope of your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of thy creation, the summoner to thy truth. Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
Nowruz special. Spring has come and has revived the frozen nature. As nature has rejuvenated, our souls are revived too. Migrating swallows are coming back, singing their songs. Nightingales are singing in chorus the sweet song of love. Nature is wearing its colorful garment. Trees have woken up and are celebrating the feast of friendship and happiness. Let us rise and breathe in fresh air, the air of spring. In the special supplication for the new year, as clock chimes in the new year, we ask God Almighty to change our state to the best of states. Now the question is, what is the best state, and when does our state become the best? The answer to this question is found in nature. If we look at nature, we will find it. Spring comes and breathes fresh life into the dead body of trees and plants. The beautiful nature not only creates picturesque sights for eyes, but also it refreshes the soul, and it gives new energy to the heart and to the spirit. Human heart sometimes becomes frosty and gloomy, like winter. Lack of affection permeates its veins of spirit and makes man frustrated and melancholic. But the nature teaches us that we can move from a frosty and dark land to a green and spring land. We can go on towards sunset and create development. Nature is generous and kind. Spring generously spreads its green cloth everywhere. Religion teaches us that every move and development is from God. Thus man should seek help from God for any development and appeal to God for the best state. The Almighty says in Ayah 186 of Surah Baqarah in the Holy Quran, "And when my servants ask you about me, I am indeed near. I answer the supplicant's call when he calls me. So let them respond to me, and let them have faith in me, so that they may fare rightly." Islamic narrations say prayer and supplication is the key to the divine mercy, and a luminous lamp for enlightening the darkness in the world and the hereafter. The supplication at the start of the new year is indeed asking God to make us good servants through linking to whatever is good and shunning whatever is evil. Spring inspires us to return to our godly nature and spread godly virtues. In Nowruz, Iranians and all those nations and ethnicities who celebrate Nowruz sit together around the Hafsin table. Hafsin tablecloth consists of seven items, beginning with the Persian letter Sin, which is equivalent to S in English. Each of these items symbolizes a phenomena. Sabzeh is green sprouts, is a symbol of rebirth and revival. Samanu is wheat sprout pudding, is a symbol of bounty and plenitude. Sumac is a symbol of sunrise. Seker or coin is a symbol of wealth. Sib or apple is a symbol of beauty and health. Serker or vinegar is a symbol of patience and life. And sir or garlic is a symbol of treatment or medicine. In addition to these seven items, Muslims place the Holy Quran too on the tablecloth, meaning that they consider this book as a role model for their lives. People in different regions and different countries add other items to the Hafsin tablecloth. They often put a mirror to symbolize purity and sincerity. The moment that the clock chimes in the new year is very significant for Iranians. Many people prefer to be in holy places, like the shrines of the infallible Imams, peace be upon them, or Imamzadehs, descendants of these Imams. That's why the holy shrine of Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Reza, peace be upon him, in the holy city of Mashhad, in northeastern Iran. And Lady Ma'sumeh, Imam Reza's sister, peace be upon her, in the city of Qom, are always overcrowded at this time of the year. However, since the coronavirus outbreak, the number of pilgrims has decreased. People try to spend their time with prayer and supplication at the moment of the new year. Moreover, most people try to be with their grandparents at this time of the year too. Then they start going to each other's homes. It is customary that the younger folks pay a visit to the elders of their family, and this will be reciprocated. As seconds tick away and the start of the new year beckons, the eldest in the family, a grandfather for example, opens the Holy Quran and gives new banknotes that have already been placed in the pages of the Holy Quran to members of the family. This is called AD. Young children are very eager to get this. Of course, they prefer to receive a toy from their grandparents. Then everybody is engaged in eating nuts and fruits. Although the coronavirus outbreak has reduced these gatherings, people try to keep these traditions, Nowruz traditions, whilst observing health protocols such as wearing face masks and refraining from shaking hands or kissing one another. Nowruz is the beginning of the new solar Hijri year. This year is the beginning of the 15th century under Iranian Persian calendar. COVID-19 has impacted gatherings, but it has failed to affect affection and love. On the contrary, people have become more loving towards each other. especially those whose job has been seriously affected by the outbreak of this disease. We do not lose hope, and we have learned from the Holy Quran that most surely, with every hardship, there is ease.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Sanctions are a topic that often go underreported. They're seen by most people as being some kind of tame, mild alternative to war. But they're just as destructive as war, if not more. They're a modern equivalent of siege warfare, just like when armies would surround a city, cutting off its food supplies and isolating the inhabitants until they either surrendered or died of malnutrition and disease. Today, I want to talk about two countries, Venezuela and Syria, that are subject to some of the worst sanctions, although they're not the only ones. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. The United States has been trying to topple the governments of Venezuela and Syria for a while now. Independent socialist countries who refuse to serve the financial and geopolitical interests of the United States usually do end up being couped, invaded, or sanctioned, sometimes all three. After all, this isn't something new. There isn't a country in Central or Latin America that the United States hasn't meddled in. We've seen the United States overthrow the democratically elected president of Guatemala in 1954. We saw a CIA-backed coup in Chile in 1973. The United States was financing death squads in Nicaragua and El Salvador in the 1980s, bombing Grenada in 1983, and much more. It's quite an extensive list. And it's important, of course, to underline this and point out the recent history, just so that there's no illusions of what's going on here. The United States and their partners are interested in regime change, and will do so for economic reasons, as they have done so in the past. Again, it's no coincidence that Venezuela, besides being an anti-imperialist socialist nation, also happens to sit on the world's largest reserves of oil. Now, sanctions against Venezuela date back to the days of the Bush regime. Every U.S. president since has taken steps to expand the embargo on Venezuela. In 2014 and 2015, Barack Obama imposed further sanctions on Venezuela, freezing assets and issuing travel bans. Then when Donald Trump took over as president, he imposed even more sanctions as part of his maximum pressure campaign. In January 2019, Trump targeted Venezuela's oil sector. The oil embargo included the Trump administration blocking sales from Venezuela's state-owned oil company, PDVSA, and then seizing its U.S. subsidiary, Citgo, which is worth billions. Remember, Venezuela relies heavily on its exports of oil for that stream of revenue, and Trump also proceeded to target its financial sector in March 2019 and its defense and security sector in May 2019. Now, although the United States claims it imposes sanctions to punish certain government officials and ministers for, you know, alleged human rights abuses and cracking down on protesters, something the United States has no problem doing on its own citizens, the United States isn't acting as some kind of benevolent moral arbiter. It wants to replace the Venezuelan government with someone more favorable to the interests of Washington, D.C., which is why the United States has been propping up the former leader of the National Assembly in Venezuela, Juan Guaido. This guy, who most Venezuelans haven't even heard of, is essentially their stooge. He's a puppet that they want to put in place in order to further their political and economic interests. As per usual, the European Union followed the lead of the United States and also imposed sanctions on Venezuela and also proceeded to push Juan Guaido as the supposed interim president of Venezuela. Now, whatever issues Venezuela had internally, these sanctions have only served to exacerbate them and as a result have spurred on one of the worst displacement crises in the world. According to the United Nations, worldwide, there are over 5 million Venezuelan refugees and migrants, and over 800,000 asylum seekers, and 2.5 million living under other legal forms of stay in the Americas. Sanctions make life hell for the people living there, and this is precisely why so many people are fleeing. The poverty rate has reached record levels and plunged the Venezuelan people into unimaginably cruel conditions. Since Venezuela's economy is so heavily dependent on oil, by blocking Venezuela from selling its oil and stealing its companies, the U.S. is essentially cutting off funding for social services and government infrastructure. They know this, and they do this anyway, hoping that the people will rise up and overthrow their government. To further examine the harsh realities of economic sanctions, I'm joined by Alina Duhan. She is the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of the unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights, or sanctions. She's also a professor of international law at the Belarusian State University, and she just returned recently from Venezuela. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on the program, Professor. It's good to have you.
It's a pleasure for me.
I wanted to ask you if you could maybe further explain the mechanism of how these sanctions can end up being so devastating for the local currency of another country and freezing the assets as well and so forth. And also how that ties into Syria, because the Syrian pound is also experiencing this hyperinflation, specifically after the implementation of the Caesar Act sanctions in June 2020.
The economic situation as well as hyperinflation started to develop in Venezuela as soon as the oil prices started to drop, starting from 2013. So there was a serious economic decrease. And the hyperinflation has already started at that point. When we speak about Syria, the Syrian economy has already been devastated by years of conflict over the years. So we need to take into account that situation was already far from good one before sanctions have been imposed. Countries, for example, Venezuela can't sell oil anymore. If you compare with 2015 and 2016, when sanctions started to be imposed, the revenue of Venezuela from selling oil dropped from 100% to 1%. So they started to get only 1% of the money they used to get because of selling oil. The mining sector of Venezuela has also been listed, and therefore they can't sell anything, can't export anything they used to get from the mining sector as well. That's why the income has dropped even further. That the assets Venezuela had in the banks of the United States, United Kingdom, and Portugal, which upon different assessments were between $5 and $6 billion, have been frozen. The country is losing income and can't pay to social services. And as a result, a lot of social projects which used to be supported by the government, in particular, the government used to provide 2 meals per day at schools. So children were fed at schools. Now it's limited to 1, and this 1 is usually very small. It doesn't contain protein. So children do not eat at schools anymore.
And how would you describe the medical and public health infrastructure in Venezuela at the moment? How much have these institutions been further imperiled, generally speaking, by these sanctions?
Before 2016, the government used to provide the full coverage of medical expenses to every citizen of Venezuela. I was visiting the cardiological child hospital. Traditionally, this hospital was doing 1,500 surgeries, heart surgeries for children per year. Last year, this hospital was only able to do 160 surgeries. So it basically means that more than 1,300 children were not able to get this surgery. I was visiting the hospitals both in Caracas and outside of Caracas. And I have been reported that in some of them, they can't even do, for example, the simple blood test because all the centrifuges are already broken. The majority of hospitals demonstrate that about 80% of equipment is already broken because it's impossible to buy spare parts for the equipment. And traditionally, Venezuela was buying the equipment either from the United States or from Europe. And that's a really serious problem.
You know, when the United States announced sanctions, they usually say that they're going to make an exception for humanitarian aid, for relief agencies. Does that actually translate into reality?
In practice, unfortunately, the majority of these humanitarian exceptions doesn't work. First of all, the procedure to get a permission to deliver humanitarian aid is lengthy and costly. That means that only huge humanitarian organizations which have a necessary legal department can be involved into that. A small one can't even effort doing that. Secondly, even if there is a possibility to get a humanitarian exceptions, it still doesn't mean that a company will be able to buy humanitarian goods because of the fear of secondary sanctions. So the majority of banks and the majority of companies outside of the countries will be scared to be involved into transactions. That if you look, for example, at the guidances which have been developed by the European Union as concerned the delivery of humanitarian aid, the burden of proof of the initial humanitarian purpose is laying on humanitarian actors. So the humanitarian organizations face the following situation. They need to find the donors. They need to find a way to get an exception. They need to prove that these goods will only be used for humanitarian purposes, and they will be responsible if anything will happen. That's why they prefer not to be involved that much in this sphere. And that's why I delivered the guidance on delivery of humanitarian aid at the end of 2020. And I called for some steps to be taken to improve situation with humanitarian exception. But the last point, which is also important, is that usually, even if it's possible to get humanitarian exception, these humanitarian exceptions are only referring to medical goods and to food. It's impossible to get a humanitarian exception to anything else. There are enormous problems, for example, to get humanitarian exceptions for something which could be considered as a dual-use goods. In Venezuela, there are serious problems with spare parts for the medical equipment, spare parts for water, electricity supply, as well as industry responsible for agriculture. And buying this equipment and buying these spare parts is never considered to fall under humanitarian exceptions.
Alina Duhan, thank you so much for your time. It's a pleasure speaking with you, Professor.
It was a pleasure for me. Thank you for interest.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Similarly to Venezuela, Syria has also been on the receiving end of brutal sanctions imposed by the United States and the European Union, all done in the aim of toppling the Syrian government and effectuating regime change. Syria has undergone the world's worst refugee crisis in modern history. Half of Syria's population has been displaced by this war, even members of my own family. According to the United Nations Refugee Agency, the UNHCR, more than 6.6 million Syrians have been forced to flee their homes since 2011, and another 6.7 million people remain displaced inside the country. And on top of all that suffering, the European Union and the United States don't stop there. It's not enough that Western powers have funded armed groups inside Syria to sow chaos, or that Israel helped al-Qaeda fighters because it suited them to see Syria fall. No, on top of all that, they go ahead and tighten the noose even further on the Syrian people. It's despicable. In June 2020, the Trump regime implemented the Caesar Act. These sanctions are the most severe and extensive sanctions Syria has ever faced, despite having been under sanctions for decades. Right now in Syria, people are queuing up in bread lines. Bread lines in a country that used to grow its own wheat and have enough wheat left over to export to other countries. People now have to wait hours just to get a little bit of bread that isn't even enough to properly feed a family. This wasn't a thing before the war. This was unheard of. People have drawn comparisons between what's happening now and the way hundreds of thousands of Iraqis were viciously starved to death by sanctions in the 1990s. Before the war on Syria started in 2011, one US dollar was equal to 47 Syrian pounds. Now, $1 is equal to 4,000 Syrian pounds on the black market. This devaluation of the currency and hyperinflation brought on by the war and exacerbated by the Caesar sanctions has completely shattered Syria's economy. And of course, given that Lebanon and Syria's economies are inextricably intertwined, and Lebanon is going through its own economic crisis, that doesn't do much to help either. Not only is the United States isolating Syria from the world and cutting off its resources, it's also holding them hostage and occupying Syria's oil fields in the northeast and the breadbasket region where its crops are grown. Last year, Senator Lindsey Graham gleefully exclaimed his approval of the fact that the U.S. had signed a deal with the Kurdish-led SDF to steal Syria's oil, and even gloated about these sadistic Caesar Act sanctions, asking like some bloodthirsty monster whether more were coming.
The Caesar's Act, thank you for using it quickly and in a holding Assad's son accountable is a great first step in what I think will be a long journey to punish this regime. Is more coming?
Yes, Senator.
Thank you. Great job.
According to the latest report from the World Food Program, a record 12.4 million Syrians, that's nearly 60% of the population, are now food insecure. In just over 1 year, an additional 4.5 million Syrians have become food insecure. Sean O'Brien, the World Food Program's representative and country director in Syria, said that the, quote, situation has never been worse. Basic foods to feed a family for a month, bread, rice, lentils, and oil and sugar, now cost at least 120,000 Syrian pounds, which far exceeds the average salaries. Over the last year, food prices across Syria have soared, and the price of basic items has increased by 236%, just as the value of the Syrian pound has plummeted. On average, the price of oil has increased from 1,000 Syrian pounds in January 2020 to 5,000 Syrian pounds in January 2021. UN Special Rapporteur Alina Duhan once again called on the United States to remove unilateral sanctions on Syria, saying, quote, the sanctions violate the human rights of the Syrian people, whose country has been destroyed by almost 10 years of ongoing conflict. The broad sweep of the United States sanctions law that went into effect in June could target any foreigner helping in reconstruction of the devastated country and even employees of foreign companies and humanitarian operators helping rebuild Syria. To talk more about these brutal Caesar Act sanctions that are gripping the Syrian population, journalist Vanessa Bealey joins me from Damascus. Vanessa, thank you for taking the time. I know you don't have a lot of electricity at the moment, ironically, because of the sanctions. How are you doing?
I love how they always term, when I say they, of course, I'm talking about the U.S. coalition, the U.S., U.K., EU, who are imposing these sanctions on the Syrian people. Let's make this really clear. You know, sanctions never target what our governments tell you that they are targeting. They target the people, some of the poorest and some of the most destabilized, traumatized people who have already gone through a 10-year war. You know, the first point I have to make is that al-Qaeda are not under sanctions. The SDF are not under sanctions. ISIS are not under sanctions inside Syria, right? Let's make that really clear. Humanitarian aid that comes into Bab al-Hawa in Idlib on the border with Turkey is being taken by al-Qaeda and is being used as part of their mafia operation to provide them with revenue. Okay, so let's make this really clear. Sanctions don't apply to the terrorists and extremist groups and the proxies of the US coalition. They only apply to those people that are living under the protection of the Syrian state and its allies, by choice. And you have to remember that the sanctions here are on top of policies like the burning of crops, the occupation of oil resources, and the theft of those oil resources. America doesn't want the oil. It wants to deprive the Syrian people of that oil and to provide revenue for its proxies, in this case, or the Kurdish separatists.
So how are people actually holding up without these commodities and, you know, electricity and gas? Because you see pictures of people lining up for bread now. I've heard stories of people putting on layers of clothes just to keep warm. So how are people managing without these necessities?
The U.S. occupation of the oil means that the refineries under the protection of the Syrian government are not receiving oil supplies. So the electrical power stations are not running efficiently. There is no gas for heating. There's no oil for heating. Yesterday, in fact, I drove past a queue of around 15 kilometers for fuel for cars, right? And this has been the situation since I've been here, which is almost 2 years now. Electricity-wise, we're on 4 hours off, 2 hours on. So effectively, every day, I only really get 6 working hours of electricity, as I call it. In the next suburb, they're lucky if they get 1 hour per day.
Can you maybe describe how much prices have gone up and how much everything has gotten more expensive? Because, you know, you've spent a couple of years in Syria, so, I mean, you've actually known how it was before, even though that was, of course, still during wartime, but still.
Well, I mean, people are always saying to me, for example, a kilo of chicken previously would have been less than 1,000 Syrian pounds. Right now, with inflation and with the scarcity of food, it's more than 10,000 a kilo. So prices have gone up 10 times. People are still earning, let's say, a Syrian Arab Army soldier is still on a salary of around $50, right? But they're expected to pay 10 times what they were paying before for food, for heating, for gas. I mean, gas now, I think when I first came, it was around 15,000 Syrian pounds for a gas canister. It's now 35,000, 40,000. And you have to queue to get it.
So, Vanessa, what are your thoughts on the mainstream media, especially in the West, how they're reporting on the sanctions or perhaps not reporting?
And it's astounding to me how Western media spins this story. You know, they talk about it all being down to the Assad regime. But in reality, the reason there are bread queues, you know, the Syrian government has maintained its provision of bread throughout the 10 years of this war, despite all of the hardships, the sanctions, the terrorist attacks, etc. And now it can't. But why? Because as we've mentioned, the burning of the crops during the summer across the country, the burning of forestry, the burning of cotton crops, the burning of olive plantations, right? And right now, the SDF, the Kurdish Contras, are stealing the wheat and barley still right now, and they're trading it cross-border, just as they're doing with the oil. And by the way, the oil is providing revenue not only for the SDF, but the SDF are then sending it to Al-Qaeda in Idlib for processing.
How would you describe the morale? How do you see the Syrian people? Are they tolerating it? Are they being resilient? How's the general psychology? And, you know, how are they holding up, given that they've gone through so much, so many years of war, and now on top of it, sanctions?
Look, Syrian people, as you know, are incredibly resourceful, incredibly resilient, incredibly steadfast. And as they always do, they're making the best of it. But they're exhausted. You know, as I said before, Syria right now should be rebuilding. For me, I think the most heartbreaking thing is the medical sector. I mean, I had a meeting with the deputy health minister last week, and chronic illnesses they're just not able to cope with because the machinery and equipment and analysis equipment that they need is breaking down. they can't get spare parts because European countries are not allowed to deal with them. And, you know, the saddest thing, there are doctors, most of these doctors, Syrian doctors, have trained in the EU. So they have contacts and they have established collaboration in the EU. But they're not allowed to collaborate under the sanctions, even for the medical sector, even for kids that have cancer. You know, this is the insanity that people need to understand. There is nothing humanitarian or protective about sanctions. It is all about destruction. It is all about killing people, really. Sanctions kill people. That's what we need to kind of get into our heads.
According to the latest figures from the United Nations Population Fund, around 30% of the Syrian population are between the ages of 0 and 14. Another 30% of Syrians are between the ages of 10 and 24. That means that 60% of Syria's population is under the age of 24. The vast majority of them have grown up in war, they've grown up with trauma, and on top of it, they're being starved and slowly choked to death now with sanctions. If that isn't heartbreaking and the definition of cruelty, I don't know what is. How on earth does anyone justify putting an entire generation of children through war, depriving them of education, and slowly murdering them with sanctions? These people are sick. They have no conscience. They're cruel. They're evil. It's very easy for them to claim that they're morally superior and that these countries, oh, they're ruled by dictators and they mismanage their economies and they caused all this. But these Western powers, they know precisely that the sanctions they inflict on others are ineffective and will ruin lives and kill civilians overseas. And they choose to do it anyway. And then they have the nerve to accuse the governments they're targeting for regime change of being responsible. This is their way of shirking responsibility and keeping this narrative going of, oh, look how brutal this regime is. We need to go and get rid of them. That's what gangsters and criminals do when they don't get their way and they can't profit off of someone else. They punish, they hurt, they lie, they kill, they steal. That's what the United States, the United Kingdom, and their allies do. They inflict immeasurable suffering on millions of people, on millions of civilians all over the world who've done nothing wrong. Whatever they accuse Chavez, Maduro, al-Assad of doing, it pales in comparison to the barbarous and cold-blooded siege warfare that they impose on the people of Venezuela, Syria, Iran, Cuba, Yemen, and others. The United States and their allies think that they can use sanctions to intimidate Venezuela, intimidate Syria, intimidate Iran and others. They think that bullying and stealing and starving us is going to work. But they are sorely mistaken. All they have done is increase the resilience and strengthen the resilience.